From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how credit cards, money market funds, and mutual funds have changed the way middle-class Americans think about and use money. We talk with Joseph Nocera about the so-called money revolution. He's the author of A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. Also today, a meditation on fathers and sons, race, and society. We talk with writer John Edgar Wideman. His new memoir, Father Along, is nominated for a National Book Award. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Love Affair, the new movie starring Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is headed for the Middle East, where he'll witness the signing of the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty. The ceremony will be held on the border between the two countries. Several violent incidents have prompted Israel to beef up security measures. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Security officials say that trying to protect the president is a security nightmare. More than 10,000 Israeli policemen will be on duty during tomorrow's signing of the Israel-Jordan peace treaty and President Clinton's visit to Jerusalem on Thursday. All guests at the King David Hotel, where President Clinton will sleep, have been asked to leave. Any road the president travels on will be closed for at least a half hour before and after his motorcade passes, promising huge traffic jams. Israeli security sources say they're most concerned about President Clinton's visit to holy sites in Jerusalem's Old City, scheduled for late Thursday night. They say they asked Mr. Clinton to skip that part of his itinerary, but he refused. Security sources say they have intelligence that the Islamic militant Hamas group is planning an attack during the visit. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Israel's parliament has formally ratified the peace treaty. The vote was 105-3, with 6 abstentions. The decision sets the stage for tomorrow's ceremonial signing of the document. Most members of Israel's opposition Likud party voted to approve the treaty, but most also say they won't attend tomorrow's ceremony. They complain the ceremony is too extravagant, since 5,000 guests have been invited. They also say it is insensitive to families who've lost relatives in recent attacks by Islamic militants. State authorities in Georgia have arrested 4 members of the Ku Klux Klan on murder charges. We have more from Rob Hilton from member station WUGA.
Officials with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation say the Ku Klux Klan murdered one of its own members. The 4 Klan suspects are charged with killing 34-year-old William Tucker, a white construction worker who lived in northeast Georgia. Tucker was found beaten and shot to death in a wooded area last week. State investigators say they don't know why the Klan would kill one of its own members, but they believe the murder may be linked to Tucker's ties with the white supremacist group. The 4 suspects charged in the case are members of the National Vastille Aryan Party, a branch of the Ku Klux Klan. Authorities say the Klan members are being held in custody without bond. For National Public Radio, I'm Rob Hilton in Athens, Georgia.
A federal judge has barred the government from returning 25 Cuban refugees to Havana. The judge in Miami has issued a temporary restraining order to stop a plane from leaving the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. That's where most of the refugees have been detained. The order came minutes before the plane was scheduled to leave. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down almost 9 points at 3,846. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is down 4.5 points at 756. This is NPR. A leading Haitian lawmaker has announced President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's formal choice for Haitian prime minister. The leader of Haiti's lower house of parliament says the new premier will be businessman Smart Michel. Aristide is expected to convene the legislature over the next 2 days to ratify Michel's candidacy. The choice of Michel is a gesture to business people, but he is being accused of political inexperience. Michel does not belong to a political party, and he served as Aristide's commerce minister for only 2 months in 1991. Federal investigators are looking into whether bad hydraulic fluid may have been partly responsible for the crash of U.S. Air Flight 427 last month. All 132 people aboard died when the plane crashed near Pittsburgh. Kevin Gavin of member station WDUQ has this report.
The rudder hydraulic fluid from the Boeing 737-300 that crashed near Pittsburgh contained more impurities than was first thought. However, investigators don't know if the contamination was serious enough to cause problems with the rudder control system. A National Transportation Safety Board spokesman says they'll conduct more tests to determine how the contaminated fluid affects the system, and they'll look at fluid samples from about two dozen other 737s for comparison. Spokesman Michael Benson says investigators will perform additional tests on Flight 427's power control unit, which moves the rudder, which turns the plane. Speculation shortly after the crash focused on a rudder problem because the jetliner rolled sharply to the left before plunging 6,000 feet to the ground. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Gavin in Pittsburgh.
Baseball mediator W.J. Ussery is meeting today with officials from the Players Union in New York. Ussery wants to meet with both sides separately before bringing them together for another bargaining session. Ussery's meeting with management has not been scheduled. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The so-called money revolution has changed financial life for the middle class. Those changes are the subject of the new book, A Piece of the Action, by Joseph Nocera, who writes the profit motive column for GQ magazine. Not too long ago, when a middle class person needed a loan, he or she would go to the bank, where a loan officer would decide how much to give and what it could be spent on. Now with credit cards, the customer decides how and when to spend large sums of money and when to pay it back. The middle class used to put its savings into savings accounts. Now there are options like CDs, money market funds, short-term bond funds, and mutual funds. Nocera says that for many people, these new options have brought a new level of financial confusion and nagging fears that they made the wrong choice or their money's at risk.
One of the things that I get at a little bit in the book is the degree to which mutual funds were begun as a device to make financial life easier. In other words, you, a middle-class person who does not have time to investigate the stock market, can give your money to a company that has professional managers who do nothing but think about the stock market day and night. And there was, I've always believed that part of the rise of the mutual fund industry has been this comfort factor, the sense that, okay, they were going to do this for you. And the degree to which this was simpler than trying to, you know, figure out which of the, you know, 3,000 stocks on the New York Stock Exchange you should put your money into. In fact, we've gotten to the point where there are now somewhere around 6,000 mutual funds. There are twice as many mutual funds as there are stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, which is just an incredibly staggering statistic. And so mutual funds, which began as this way to make life simpler, have actually made life much more complicated. And when people are given 401k plans, which is the classic thing that's happening in America today, and they're told, okay, here's a 401k, you know, good luck, and hope you have enough to retire on, it's up to them to decide which funds to put it in and, you know, whether to go for a growth fund or a balanced fund and all this kind of stuff. And people's eyes just tend to glaze over and they say, you know, I can't face it. I can't deal with it. And I think that's what a lot of people are feeling in America today. And I think that's one of the reasons there's so much anxiety about money today.
One of the things you write about in your new book is how the era of inflation in the 70s changed the middle class's thinking about spending and saving. And how even though that era of inflation may be over, a lot of us are still thinking in the same patterns. What spending and saving patterns were changed by inflation?
What happened in the era of inflation was that people realized that those old values of thrift, of not borrowing, of not being in the market, of not thinking about your money were passé. They didn't work anymore. And the classic example, and this is what really began this major change in American life. It's 1980. The prime rate is 20%. The inflation rate is 13%. The Treasury bills are offering 15, 16, 17%. And there you are with your money in the bank, and it's earning 5.25% because it's federally regulated. The money in bank passbooks account was regulated by the federal government. And that's what they wanted it to be, and they wanted it to be 5.25% for a whole bunch of historical reasons. And you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you think to yourself, oh, my God, what is my money doing in the bank? I'm getting killed. And so this process began where one person after another would take that money out of the bank, and they would put it in this thing called a money market fund, which wasn't even that old as an investment vehicle. It was only 6 or 7 years old. But it was a place where you could begin to get real-world interest rates instead of bank interest rates. Thus began this long historical trek of middle-class money out of the bank and into what eventually became the market. That's one side of it. The other side of it has to do with borrowing behavior. I mean, I firmly believe that inflation taught Americans that it made sense to borrow. Because you were buying, if you borrowed, you were buying things with cheaper dollars than if you saved the money and paid for it in cash.
Well, why would that be?
If you borrowed on a credit card and you timed it properly and you bought a refrigerator with a credit card, the bill didn't come due for, say, 45 days. So, in essence, you're getting an interest-free loan for 45 days. During those 45 days, when inflation is really rearing its ugly head, prices may have gone up, or refrigerators may have gone up 5 or 6%. So by borrowing, you are in effect paying 5 or 6% less money than if you had paid cash for that same good.
So do you think that inflation-era attitudes are still operating in the middle class today, and are we still in an inflationary period?
I don't think we're in an inflationary period. I do think that the that ethos remains in effect. What I basically believe is that people's economic behavior changes in the wake of a cataclysmic economic event. And then it doesn't change again until there's another event to force it to change. So the Depression was one event, and so even though you had the wonderful 1950s, there was a lot of depression, the mentality of the Depression still stuck. And then you had inflation, which basically forced people. It wasn't dramatic the way the Depression was, but it did force people to change their economic behavior. And then we haven't had a new cataclysmic economic event to make them change again. There's been nothing sort of compelling that tells people, you know, stop borrowing or put your money in the bank. That's why I think behavior has stayed the same, even though the event itself has receded into memory.
How should the middle class, do you think, be adjusting its spending and saving now that we're out of the inflation era?
One of the things that happened in the era of inflation and that really propelled the bull market of the 1980s was this notion that people had that they had a God-given right to double-digit yields. So if you're getting in a money market fund 15% circa 1980, 1981, and interest rates start coming down, I think one of the things that really propelled money in the market is the sense that people had is, you know, by God, you know, I was getting 15%. I still want to get 15%. And if I can't get it in a money market fund, then I'm going to go into the market. I'm going to put my money in Fidelity, Magellan, you know, whatever I need to do. I've always thought that economists will tell you there's something very sort of deceptive and wrong-headed about the notion that they were in fact getting 15% during that era, because what they were really doing was that they were beating the inflation rate by about 2%. So even though they were getting 15%, inflation was cutting 13% of that away. So here we are today, and people are still, as they say, chasing for yield. They're not trying to get 11 or 12 because that's kind of impossible these days, but they're still trying to get 6, 7, 8% in an era when Treasury bills are yielding 4 and 5%. And what's deceptive about that and what's causing them to have problems about that is that the gap between what you're getting in a Treasury bill and what inflation is still only about 2%. I mean, the difference it's really not that different. But people have it in their brain that they ought to be able to get higher interest. They ought to be able to get more money on their money. So they're chasing after something that's basically going to cause them problems because it entails a kind of risk that I believe most Americans are uncomfortable with.
A good deal of your book is devoted to credit cards and the history of the credit card and, you know, how the credit card has changed. What is so important about the credit card and how it changed the spending habits of the middle class?
The credit card really is the device that gave you control over your borrowing habits. And that I've always thought the more interesting thing about the credit card is the psychological effect it has on Americans. They know it's important. They know that they need to take care of they have to be responsible with their credit and so on. And yet it bubbles up all these issues of temptation and willpower and sin and, you know, this notion that they could get into trouble tomorrow if they don't watch out. I remember during the course of researching the book, I would go to a party, and I would say, I would just sort of offhandedly mention that I was researching the history of credit cards. And it would be like dropping a hand grenade in the room or something. I mean, all of a sudden, this thing that had resided in people's subconscious came flooding to the front of their brain. And I would, you know, be assaulted with questions like, you know, how can they send me these solicitations? Don't they know I already have 9 credit cards? What are they trying to do to me? Why won't they leave me alone? And everybody had a tale about a credit report that was inaccurate, and everybody had a tale about, a collection agency going after them unfairly. And these were people who, basically upper middle class people who were in control of their credit, who could afford to pay their bills on time, et cetera, et cetera. So the credit card has had, I think, among every other thing, enormous psychological ramifications in the way people think about their own borrowing behavior.
Well, one of the early big events in the history of the credit card is in 1958, when Bank of America sends out 60,000 credit cards to residents of Fresno, California, floating this new idea.
Right.
What was the experiment?
No one had ever before devised a card that could be used that could both be used in a whole bunch of different places, different kind of stores, and that also gave you the capability either to borrow or to pay it off at the end of the month. I mean, that choice became yours. And that's one of the ways people had to kind of decide for themselves. Do I want to be a borrower or do I want to use it as a convenience device? Also, the Bank of America card was the first one that was really aimed at middle-class people. The American Express card and the Diners Club before that were really aimed at professionals, and they had this kind of business aura about them. The second thing about it that I found sort of fascinating, especially given the degree to which credit cards are this immense, impersonal, computerized business today, is that it was intended actually not to be impersonal, but to be just to be one of these wonderful things, wonderful tools that bond you to your wonderful bank, the Bank of America, which, of course, didn't happen at all. I mean, even in Fresno and even in California, where the Bank of America card quickly spread, this resentment came up right away. People were very upset at the idea that they could walk into their mailbox one day and there would be this piece of plastic there that gave them borrowing capabilities. It was very, very bothersome to people. And they really did feel that the Bank of America was doing the devil's work.
So what was the result of this experiment?
Well, the result of the experiment was that everybody started using credit cards. And that's what's so interesting about it. They blanketed the state of California with cards within less than a year, because they had heard a rumor that another bank was going to get into the business, and the Bank of America was so big and powerful, they just want to flatten the competition. And because in those days you could just send the cards out and you didn't have to solicit as you do today, you know, crooks got cards, dogs got cards. I mean, this is kind of one of the more famous events in the history. It happened again in the 60s in America, but it happened in California first in the 50s. And there was a huge outcry. That's the other thing. I mean, you can't overemphasize. You know, cards were denounced from pulpits and churches all over the state. Many of the sort of well-to-do citizenry who had gotten cards, you know, cut them up and sent them to the bank and said, I'm moving my money out of this bank in protest, et cetera, et cetera. There was this giant outcry.
So how did the credit card survive when everything went so wrong?
Well, this, I think, gets to the psychology. It actually does offer convenience. It really does. And especially when we get to the 60s, and credit cards start blanketing the country. The same thing happens in the country that happened in California. I mean, 100 million cards. This is an amazing fact. 100 million cards got dropped on America between 1968 and 1970 when it was outlawed, the dropping of cards. And there were so many cards in circulation that people, you know, gradually started using them.
Joseph Nocera is my guest. His new book is called A Piece of the Action, and it's about how spending and saving has changed in the middle class. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with Joseph Nocera. He's the author of a new book called A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. What is the difference between MasterCharge and Visa, or MasterCard and Visa?
There isn't any. I mean, they're two separate organizations, and part of what the book, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about Visa, mainly because it is the, it used to be the Bank AmeriCard. The name was changed in 1977. But when the industry was just beginning to come into its own, banks had to decide, am I going to go with the Bank AmeriCard? Am I going to line up with them and be a franchise bank for the Bank AmeriCard? Or am I going to be a franchise bank with this organization called MasterCharge? It was called Interbank, but MasterCharge was the card that they issued. And basically, there were two competing organizations. They're not banks. All they are is they offer the kind of back office computerized systems that make the whole thing work smoothly. And basically, the country got divided into Bank AmeriCard banks and MasterCharge banks. They competed fiercely for about 10 years. But what happened was Worthen Bank in Arkansas sued Bank AmeriCard, claiming that they had that it was antitrust implications to them not being allowed to carry both cards. And fundamentally, the Justice Department wound up agreeing with Worthen Bank. The bank was allowed to take both cards, as was every other bank in the country. And at that point, the two organizations, although they do still compete in many countries, are peas in a pod in the United States. I mean, there's virtually no difference between the two of them.
Don't a lot of people have MasterCard and Visa now?
Oh, everybody does. I mean, you know, absolutely. And it makes absolutely no difference. I mean, what matters really is the bank that issues the card to you and how good they are and what kind of credit standards. And really, the things people care about these days with credit cards have nothing to do with MasterCard and Visa. They have to do with, you know, what's the interest rate and what's the minimum payment and, you know, can I get frequent flyer miles?
Exactly, right.
You know, which is the one great perk in credit cards. Which also shows, by the way, what a commodity this thing has become. I mean, there's such, you know, six of one, half dozen another, that if you can offer frequent flyer miles, that's the way to get, as they say in the trade, primacy in the wallet, that's what they call the card that you take up most often. I mean, the one psychological thing they do understand in the business is that if you have five cards in your pocket, you have mentally categorized each of those five cards, and they do different things for you.
Another really big event in the history of the credit card was the recent entry of AT&T into the credit card world. You said this was the banker's worst nightmare. What was the significance of it?
Well, it's true. It was. See, as long as banks had this little business to themselves, they kind of had this implicit, unspoken agreement that they would keep interest rates high and that they would continue to charge annual fees. What happened when AT&T jumped into the game was that they had a completely different set of standards and of profit expectations. So they went out and they said, no annual fee for life if you take this card. And there was a deluge of people to take the card. They didn't start, I won't say they started at 8 or 9%, but they started at 16 or 17%. So suddenly the interest rate becomes a factor in the way people are thinking about cards. And two things have happened subsequently. The first is that 45% of the credit card business in this country is now done by non-banks, which is an astounding fact. This thing was built by banks. It was made for banks. It was a banker's device. And so what had been the cushiest of deals for the bank has now become their credit cards are only, believe it or not, in many cases only marginally profitable, and it's become immensely competitive in a way that it wasn't as recently as 4 years ago. There's one other wonderful little thing that's going on in that world right now, which I find at least amusing. You get these solicitations, I'm sure you've gotten them, where they say, the bank will say, if you move your balance to us, we'll only charge you 7 or 8% on that balance. Have you gotten these?
I've got my credit cards. I don't need more. Right. And so I don't even read what they send me.
Right.
But unless it's about frequent flyer miles.
Right. This is the new technique. They're saying, you know, we'd like to offer you a credit card, but what we really want is your unpaid balance because that's how we make money. And therefore, we'll just charge you 8-9% if you send us your unpaid balance. And the term in the trade for that is balance piracy.
Hmm.
or balance poaching, I think they call it. And that's, I mean, that's what it's come to for the banks. The only way they can make money on credit cards now is stealing each other's unpaid balances.
When you look at the pluses and minuses, do you think on the whole the middle class has benefited by the proliferation of credit cards?
The whole business of whether this whole financial revolution has been good or bad, I think, is a really, really difficult thing to grapple with. I actually think that there is something to be said for life in the 50s, in this particular case at least, that mm-hmm. the nostalgia is not misplaced. I think there's something debilitating about having to think about your money all the time. And I think that, there's so much else to life besides your money, and that American culture can get sort of caught up in this in a way that is unhealthy. On the other hand, because we live in the times that we live in, because inflation took place, because the real world is so complicated and we are all connected to the markets and so on and so forth. I do think that much of what's happened is basically inevitable, and that you sort of just have to deal with it. And this is both on the credit side and on the investment and savings side. It's not fun necessarily, but there is something democratic. I mean, in 1970, this is one example that really drives me crazy and really made me think, oh yeah, this stuff was good that it happened. In 1970, interest rates hit 8%, which was the highest they'd been since the Civil War. And it was a shock to a lot of people that interest rates would actually fluctuate after being the same for 25 years or so. And a lot of Americans went to the Federal Reserve to buy Treasury bills, which you could then get for $1,000. This was their way of kind of trying to deal with the high interest rates. And the government reacted by raising the minimum on a T-bill from $1,000 to $10,000. And the reason they did that was to force middle-class money back into the bank and to basically prevent middle-class people from getting the kind of returns that are common for wealthy people. And so, to the extent that this has brought about financial democracy and that it's allowed all of us to participate in something that only wealthy people could participate in, I think that's good. The hard part is that wealthy people usually have financial advisors, and they don't, they are generally quite often educated about the markets, and they have some sense of what they're risking and what they're doing. And I think middle-class people are still learning how to cope with this world.
Joseph Nocera, he's the author of A Piece of the Action, How the Middle Class Joined the Money Class. He writes the profit motive column for GQ. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his memoir, Brothers and Keepers, John Edgar Wideman tried to understand the forces that enabled him to become a college basketball star, Rhodes Scholar, novelist, and professor, while his brother turned to a life of crime and is serving a life sentence for murder. Coming up, we talk with Wideman about his new memoir, A Meditation on Fathers and Sons, Race and Society. It's nominated for a National Book Award. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Love Affair, starring Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Edgar Wideman's family story leaves you baffled by the mysteries of human behavior. Wideman is a former college basketball star and Rhodes Scholar who is now a college professor, novelist, and winner of 2 Penn Faulkner Awards. His brother Robbie is serving a life sentence for murder. Wideman's memoir, Brothers and Keepers, reflected on the forces that enabled him to get out of the ghetto while his brother fell into a life of crime. More recently, Wideman has been consumed by another family tragedy. His own son is serving a life sentence for a 1986 murder. Although Wideman prefers not to discuss his son and his brother, he's written a new memoir that he describes as a meditation on fathers and sons, race and society, called Father Along. It's a nominee for the National Book Award in Nonfiction. Let's start with a short reading.
The first rule of my father's world is that you stand alone. Alone, alone, alone. A fact about which we have no choice or say, carved in stone above the portal we enter when we arrive on this earth. Your work in the world is to grasp this truth, never lose sight of it, turn it so it catches light from all angles, squeeze it till its hardness, its intractability, is alchemied into a source of strength. Accept the bottom line, icy clarity of the one thing you can rely on, nothing. Your power, your work, is to exempt yourself from illusion, handle yourself, conduct your business without ever forgetting who and what you can count on. Nothing. You are proud when you don't let yourself forget and always wind up regretting your slips, those occasions when you compromise, when you let go of the truth even for a second, even in the smallest exchanges with the few people you allow a smidgen closer to you than you allow anyone else. You are, if you're my father, calculating, relentless, disciplined beyond belief in adhering to this self-imposed regimen. Not because it brings happiness or satisfaction in the usual sense. You don't expect to make things better. You don't do what you do in order to produce consequences anywhere but within your own skull, on the meter, toting up your hard-headed power to deny, to withdraw, to remain detached. What counts is the doing, the discipline, the engagement with nothing on its own terms. My mother's first rule was love. She refused to believe she was alone. Be not dismayed, whate'er betides, God will take care of you.
John Edgar Wideman, thank you for reading that. Which world were you most comfortable in, the world where the philosophy is you're alone, or which is your father's, or the world of your mother's philosophy, that love is everything?
Well, I think I was a tennis ball, and I bounced back and forth from one to the other. And in a sense, that's what Father Along is about, trying to reconcile the power of the mother and the power of the father and the form that power takes in our particular society.
Do you see those two different worldviews, one that you're alone and the other that everything is about love, as being a function of gender or just the specific views of your father and your mother?
Well, not necessarily attached to gender, but I think I was culturally conditioned to attach warmth and love and closeness to a sort of female principle, or my mother, and and something else entirely, like strength and power and independence to a male principle, something like my father.
You write that you never learned how to behave when you encountered your father's hardness. What was difficult about encountering that?
What was difficult is, I think, the very lesson he was trying to teach me, and that is not everybody in the world loves you, and that you have to be prepared for that, and you have to expect doors to be slammed in your face. You have to expect people to disappoint you. You have to expect the world to turn out not the way you always want it. And I think my father had experienced all of those, all that negativity personally, as an individual, as a member of an African-American community particularly. And in a sense, it was his responsibility to keep me aware and alert of that side of things.
Your father left the family when you were 28 and when your youngest brother was 17 or 18. So you had a father at home when you were growing up, but it sounds like you never really spent that much time with him, in part because he was busy working much of the time. That's the predicament so many children have been in who have fathers.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, which meant that I had to create a father in my imagination. And that might be the beginning of, or one of the places where my imagination begins to take the form that it eventually did take in order to be a writer, dealing with absence, making something out of nothing, having great feeling, great affection for my father, knowing he had a great affection and love for me, but not having it at hand, not being able to simply reach out and touch it. So I had to make a place in myself where I could make contact with him.
Did you like your father when you were young, and do you like him now? And I don't mean love in the sense that sons love their fathers. I mean like him as a man.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. There was some fear in all this, but that fear was also respect. I mean, he was a big body and I was a little body. He had all the power. I had no power. But what I liked was I remembered him as an athlete. I remembered his shoes and how large they were. And I remembered his strength. I remembered him sort of shadow boxing in the house and the way he could make the air pop when he did that. And he's a very engaging person. He liked to joke around and smile. By the time I was an adult, now of course my reactions were more complex. I knew that that he and my mother had their problems, marital problems. I knew that he was sometimes around and sometimes not. So he became much more of a person rather than a mythical figure. But I still had those childhood reminiscences of closeness and his power and that attraction.
Do you feel that you live in a different world than your father does? Your father lives in a housing project with a lot of senior citizens who are on Social Security, and they're preyed on by hoodlums and junkies in the neighborhood. You're a professor at a university. You've lived in several different places. You taught in Wyoming for many years. You teach in Amherst, Massachusetts now. You travel in a very different world, a world of, you know, very educated people, very middle-class people.
I think one burden of my writing has been to remind myself and remind other people that those aren't really different worlds, that they're obviously separate in many ways. But unless we pay more attention to the necessary connections and the ethical and moral connections between these kinds of different worlds, then we're all doomed.
My guest is John Edgar Wideman. His new memoir is called Father Along. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Edgar Wideman, whose new memoir is a meditation on fathers and sons, race and society. The ghetto was a world you wanted to get out of, and you succeeded. Your father is still in it. Do you feel this responsibility to help him get out? Do you think he'd want to get out? I think that's a complicated thing for anyone in a family that kind of changes class from their parents.
Yeah, the class and race and gender are all involved because they're all defined by the kind of world that you grow up in and then the world that you might find some way to enter because of your job or whatnot. I think that for me, I never really left that world. I never really left it, not emotionally. And part of what I'm doing in this book, Father Along, and in the writing that I do is reconstructing that world for myself and for other people, and reconstructing the possibilities of reconciliation. And I don't think of it as I don't think of the place I grew up as a ghetto. I think of it sometimes in those terms. And I know you don't necessarily mean anything negative by that phrase or that word ghetto, but I hated that word. I refused to use it for years and years and years.
What did it mean to you?
It was a put down, simply. It was somebody saying something nasty or negative about a world they usually didn't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And so it was a word that sort of that would make me angry, whether I saw it in print or whether people used it. It's a label. And all my life I've been resisting labels. But it's become almost it's an unavoidable term to describe lower socioeconomic areas, depressed areas where black people live. But it's still, once it becomes universal and once everybody begins to use it, it's not something only about a word. It's a whole attitude. It's a whole stance towards that community. I've always preferred the word community. And then you can say, well, economically it's depressed, but another way it's not, and et cetera, et cetera. Because with community is much more open-ended. It allows for some kind of negotiation of what in fact is there.
The final part of your book, Father Along, is about your relationship to your son, Jake. And Jake was convicted of murdering his roommate on a summer camping trip. Both of them were 16 at the time. He's now spending a life sentence in prison. And I'm wondering if thinking about your son is part of what led you to reexamine your relationship to your father.
Well, I think it's the other way around. I think I had a very specific desire for some reasons we've discussed and some not, that I wanted to write about my father, to look at history. But I realized also I was broaching a subject that is kind of circular. I'm a father and a son, and I also have a son. And so I needed to think, or I did think, about my kids as I wrote this book about my father. I realized also that I was writing this book about my father as a way of preserving a family past and a collective past. And so in that sense, it was addressed to my children.
Where are things now in your son's case?
They are in a place where I can't really talk about because they're still live legal issues. And I've been advised not to talk about them while things are still in flux. And it's been a long time and it's crazy, but that's still the case.
Do you think you'll ever write a more extensive piece about your son, Jake, or is that something that you think you might never care to share in detail with the public? It strikes me that it must be very hard for you as a writer who's trying to come to terms with the subject of fathers and sons and also race and class in America. And one of the most complex personal stories is a story that I don't think you really want to talk about very much, which I understand, but I'm wondering if at some point you think you might.
Well, the advantage of being a writer is you talk about things in your own way.
Right.
And sometimes people can look at your biography and make guesses about what, in fact, you're writing about and thinking about. But other times they can't. And so it's a complicated way of taking the fifth, if you will. It's also a way of maintaining privacy, but having the luxury for a writer of dealing with very complex and personal material, but not in the sort of yellow journalistic way, you know, like those newspapers you see in the supermarket. I mean, I can talk about how I feel about my daughter and her basketball, but you as reader would not necessarily know that because you might be reading a story about a soccer player who's a boy or a male. Or I can talk about my anger at the legal system, and it wouldn't necessarily take the form of an autobiographical essay that has to do with anybody that you would recognize or that somebody else could attach. That's literature is more complex than that. Literature is not reductive. It allows for one thing. One reason I like to write is because I can both explore the most intimate, personal issues and problems, but do it in my terms, in my way, so that I can still maintain that privacy.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Edgar Wideman's new memoir, Father Along, is nominated for a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is heading for the Middle East. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson will be going over the trip and what it means for the president to be going to the Middle East at this time. Also, we'll be talking to John Itzde about the economy and the president's argument that he should be getting more credit for what is happening in the economy. We also will check in with a single-handed sailing race, which has reached a milestone with a woman out front. Sprint merging with cable companies, a Democratic campaign in Minnesota. And Bailey White has an essay for us on E.B. White.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Neither Warren Beatty nor Annette Bening has made a film since they were married a few years and two babies ago. In fact, neither one has made a film since they starred together in Bugsy in 1991. But that's nothing compared to Katharine Hepburn, who hasn't made a movie since her Oscar award-winning performance in On Golden Pond in 1981. Now all these rare birds have come together under the direction of Glenn Gordon Caron, who made Clean and Sober and Wilder Napalm. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Love Affair.
Once upon a time, there was a movie called Love Affair. I'm talking about Once Upon a Time in 1939, when it was a silky shipboard romance starring Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer, directed by Leo McCarey. In 1957, McCarey remade it as An Affair to Remember, starring Cary Grant and Deborah Carr. This time, the witty shipboard romance got bogged down in soap when the lovers hit the shore. But no matter, people loved it anyway. So much so that it became the centerpiece of Sleepless in Seattle, in which it was portrayed as the film that evokes heartfelt tears in all women and complete indifference in all men. All men except Warren Beatty, that is. For reasons that may have something to do with his wish to reestablish himself as a romantic lead, and may also have something to do with his wish to duplicate the success of Heaven Can Wait 16 years ago, Beatty has remade Love Affair yet again, and for a while the audience can be glad he did. Very cleverly, he and his co-writer, Robert Towne, contrived to get their two would-be lovers on an ocean liner for the shipboard romance part. And very cleverly, Beatty and Towne get some sexy romantic chit-chat going. Beatty plays Mike Gambrill, a former star football coach who's now doing sports commentary on television. As a womanizer, he's almost in the Warren Beatty League. But now he's engaged to marry a powerful TV honcho played by Kate Capshaw. Then he bumps into what he takes to be a beautiful stranger, Annette Bening. She plays Terry McKay, a decorator whose entire career is devoted to designing the mansions and yachts of her fiancé, played by Pierce Brosnan. Very quickly, Bening gives Beatty to understand that they've actually known each other before, and rather intimately, she hints, only he's forgotten, which leaves Beatty on the rainy deck of an ocean liner, scrambling to finesse the situation.
Is this uncomfortable for you?
What?
I mean, given our history and...
Oh, well, I don't think either of us want to give people the wrong idea.
Yeah, no.
I mean, why ask for trouble?
Right.
You do attract a certain amount of attention,
well,
you know.
As do you, and very deservedly, I might add.
Thank you.
But listen, I'm nothing if not discreet. But that's common knowledge.
If it were common knowledge, you wouldn't be discreet. But I'm fine with our history.
Oh, thank you.
Now the filmmakers have a problem. How do you move the romance from the brittle chit-chat stage toward the goal, which is massive tear-jerk? First, you have to make the audience adore the characters, and here is where the filmmakers immediately go awry. The smartest way would be to make your characters substantial and sympathetic. The cornball old Hollywood way is to get sweet old ladies and sweet little children and cute little puppies to love them and hope that the sentiment will rub off. Love Affair trots out everything but the puppies. And when the sweet old lady turns out to be Katharine Hepburn, well, even if the sequence she's in is utter rubbish, which it is, it's still a treat to see the greatest living movie actress at work again. But the longer Love Affair plods on, the sudsier and mopier and sillier it gets, with only a few brief moments of Gary Shandling as Beatty's agent to spark it to life. Then, too, there's the misfortune of this movie's timing, a full year after we've all digested Sleepless in Seattle. As Warren Beatty stands on the observation deck of the Empire State Building near closing time, he's waiting for Annette Bening, but you could be confused into thinking Meg Ryan was about to trip through the door. Me, I was hoping for King Kong.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Recently, when we reviewed Ed Wood, we mistakenly said that the film's director, Tim Burton, also directed Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. Tim Burton did write the story and co-produced Nightmare Before Christmas, but it was directed by Henry Selick. We stand corrected. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of one family's wrongful conviction as IRA terrorists. We talk with Anne McGuire and her son Patrick, the aunt and cousin of Jerry Conlon, whose story was told in the film In the Name of the Father. Anne spent 8 years in prison. Patrick was 13 when he began his 4 years in prison. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.